For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Well, the cuts to health and mental health get real as agencies begin announcing what programs now face the chopping block while lawmakers delay fixing a shortfall in the budget. Mental Health Commissioner Terry White says her agency is cutting all state-funded outpatient services. Health officials announced cuts to 9 child abuse prevention services and 25 community health centers. Neva, this is looking pretty grim.
Well, it's an interesting scenario for sure, because what we have is basically bases loaded, top of the ninth, and now it's really crunch time. And I think what we have with these agencies coming forward this week is we have this attempt, it would appear to me, by the agencies, and frankly, I think with probably support of the governor and the executive branch, to try to put pressure back on the legislature. Many expect that they may come back in next week after the building is reopened, and try to get something done. I mean, it's clear that when you start talking about these kind of cuts that affect people all across the state, I mean, it certainly ups the ante. And I think now the question is, do they come back in? Do they do a quick fix and deal with the immediate shortfall and then wait to address these other issues down the road in the regular session in February? Or do we continue to drag this out with the increased pressure, I think, on lawmakers as these folks that are being directly impacted clearly are going to ramp it up and be not only on their doorstep at the Capitol, phone calls, emails, even protests, I could see it being part of this. So it's going to be an interesting scenario, and it certainly seems to be one that, from all indications, it was well orchestrated to try to set the stage where people would pay attention to this.
Ryan.
We're on the precipice of a truly terrifying situation. The safety and welfare of every single Oklahoman is about to decrease significantly. Commissioner Terry White, the commissioner of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, earlier this week outlined what these cuts would mean. We're looking at hundreds of thousands of Oklahomans that will have a direct and an immediate impact as a result of these cuts. Mental health services, crisis services for the most at-risk, vulnerable adult population, for children around the state of Oklahoma, are on the verge of being eliminated. We have providers that are throughout the state, both in metropolitan and rural areas, that are going to probably close doors, begin to lay off employees. So even if we get to a point where the legislature comes back and puts money into the system, if these cuts are allowed to go through, we may see some of the providers in a position where they can't rebound very quickly. So regardless of what happens right now, we're in a very dangerous situation. You know, you hear lawmakers talking about they want to recruit business here. Forget about recruiting business here. You want to keep people in Oklahoma? Forget about keeping people here, because what we're doing is we're failing the most vulnerable and at risk in our society. And as a result, we're going to be putting them in prison cells. We're going to be putting them in jails, and we're going to be putting a lot of them in the ground.
And with mental health, there's also worry about crime increasing as well.
And here's the question, I think, in my mind is, will the lawmakers decide to come back in and address this issue, period? I mean, the budgets have been set. I mean, it is clear that some of this could be stopped or slowed down. I mean, these drastic cuts, worst case scenario, could be mitigated. Now, will it be? I think that's going to be the will of the lawmakers. I mean, to this point, they've said, we don't want a lapse in services. We don't want to see these things happen. But they've also not come back with a solution to how to deal with the shortfall. So, I mean, there's $600 million and revolving funds. One of the things I'm now hearing, you know, around among folks at the Capitol is, I mean, is there a possibility that that they could use some of that money, set it up where they could have legislation where they could repay it? The revenue is increasing. They're exceeding their budget forecast. So there are some bright things on the horizon. But the backdrop of all of this, with the intense pressure based on the cuts that are being talked about, they've got to come up with a solution, and they've got to do it quickly.
And let's remember how we got here. We didn't get here overnight. This budget crisis is over a decade in the making. Last night I was watching a local news affiliate, and they were talking about this very story. And what they said was it was the result of the Oklahoma Supreme Court declaring the cigarette tax unconstitutional. That's not why this happened. You know, the Supreme Court did its job. They declared an unconstitutional piece of legislation unconstitutional. The legislature knew this back in the spring when they sent this out to the governor to be signed. The governor knew it when she signed it. This is no surprise how we got here. So, you know, we need to get beyond this idea of you know, that this is a surprise. I mean, we're here
and
now.
And let's be clear. I mean, we have a large number of these legislators, particularly many in the freshman class, I think, that have not gone through years of this budgetary process. And frankly, I think there's a lot of frustration even among lawmakers that they've not been able to work through and come up with some sort of a deal. I mean, now, will it be the grand bargain? Will it be what the governor wants? You know, at this point, there certainly aren't the votes there, and no one, you know, says that that's going to happen. But they've got to come up with something. And I think you're right, Ryan. It's an ongoing debate. But at some point, you've got to stop and fix the immediate problem, and then decide how you're going to fight that battle on down the road.
The American Civil Liberties Union files a lawsuit against a controversial drug rehabilitation center in Northeast Oklahoma. A report from the Center for Public Integrity finds patients being forced to work at chicken farms without pay. Ryan, I understand that it's not actually against CARE, the Christians for
Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery.
Right.
And to be clear, these two lawsuits that have been filed so far are not ACLU lawsuits. We've been in contact with those attorneys. And I think that, you know, those suits will mirror some additional litigation that folks should look for in the coming weeks. ACLU is most likely going to be involved in some of those pieces of litigation. We're talking with plaintiffs right now, or potential plaintiffs. And there are also other organizations in the state of Oklahoma that are doing essentially what CARE, Christians, Alcoholics, and Addicts in Recovery, have been doing, which is really to make a mockery of what recovery and substance abuse treatment really looks like. In our previous segment, we talked about how the state is on the precipice of these dramatic, drastic cuts to mental health and substance abuse services. What happens whenever you remove that is you get a bunch of imposters that come in, and in an unregulated industry, essentially, I mean, it's unregulated. If you've got judges and prosecutors that are willing to put people in these facilities, they go to these facilities and they gut chickens, and they, you know, we've seen people seriously injured. And then what the recovery is after they've worked 12-hour days, basically for no money whatsoever, probably in violation of the 13th Amendment, which prohibits slavery and indentured servitude in the United States of America. After that, they have to sit down and go through an hour of an AA or NA-style meeting while they're, you know, dead tired, and then they go to their bunks. And that's what this is. It's not recovery.
Neva.
Well, I think it is. I mean, the allegations certainly on the surface are outrageous. I mean, you're right. If you're talking about violation of the 13th Amendment, you're talking about violating federal and state labor laws, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of minimum wage and overtime, breach of contract, you're talking about, the potential of these folks running this facility, enriching themselves at the expense of the workers, whether it was through the workers' comp claim that is being alleged that they took the money and the person did not get the medical care that they needed. I mean, there are some very serious allegations in these lawsuits, and they definitely need to be gone through the court process very quickly. The other thing is, I mean, it was focused and highlighted even earlier this month in the Oklahoman with an investigative article that pointed out many of these things that now are coming to bear in the pages of these lawsuits.
And of course, the most interesting thing was I read in the Tulsa World yesterday from the Center for Investigative Reporting was that Dr. Doug Cox, Representative Doug Cox, went to lawmakers and said, don't regulate these businesses that are in my district. And they took out that one particular area.
Right. So and he did that while he was on the board of CARE.
Right.
And so, you know, a direct conflict of interest. And he did not disclose that. You know, the two lawmakers, Representative Derby and Representative Murphy, who he went to with that amendment, he did not, according to them, disclose that he was on the board of that organization at the time, and then voted on his own amendment, which, you know, I think is a violation of the conflicts of interest rules that govern how legislators can act on things that they have a direct or immediate interest in.
Well, it raises some other issues. I mean, the fact that it appears that it is not a certified program, drug treatment program through the Department of DMH, that's another issue that I think, again, falls into the purview of these lawmakers as they start to look at some of these issues that they can also have some direct impact on beyond what's going on in the courts.
And as we also turn toward more trying to put people in drug courts and drug rehabilitation centers, that does there need to be more oversight of these kinds of things?
All of these services, if we're going to be placing people in drug courts or mental health courts, they need to be evidence-based. They need to be evidence-based. They need to recognize the scientific method behind recovery and substance abuse treatment. That's what these don't do. And I think that it shows that a lot of prosecutors out there, these tough-on-crime prosecutors that want to act like they have some compassionate streak by putting people in these programs, that they don't truly understand these programs either. They don't understand what recovery and treatment really look like. And in some cases, neither do judges. You have judges saying, this is the last resort for these folks. And that's not always true, because we've met some people that went to these on their first appearance in the criminal justice system. But regardless, whether this is your first appearance or your 20th appearance in the criminal justice system, to put people there and to pretend that we're putting them in treatment is a real disservice to the people of Oklahoma and the people of Arkansas as well.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions comes to Oklahoma to speak to the Sheriff's Association. We are recording this as the event is actually going on, but with the association's opposition to corrections reform and the addition of Representative Scott Biggs, who stomped major corrections reform legislation. Neva, it doesn't take much imagination to get what this speech is probably about.
Well, and certainly it was the Attorney General his office that initiated the interest in coming and speaking to this meeting of the Oklahoma Sheriff's Association. Some have said that this is the first time a sitting Attorney General has spoken before any group of Oklahomans in our state. So, I mean, with respect to that, I mean, that is significant. I mean, regardless of your feeling about an administration, when you have these individuals serving in these high public places, I mean, it's certainly noteworthy. I mean, I think it will be interesting to see what comes out in terms of what is said in his speech. I mean, there'll be a number of other folks that will be talking during the course of the program. But, I mean, he clearly has been a high profile and a very controversial attorney general, as many attorney generals have been. I think we could say that about his predecessor and probably any recent memory, just given the work that they do in the scope of their office.
Ryan.
Well, AG Sessions' policy, criminal justice policy, is out of step with reality, and it's out of step where most Oklahomans are at. 58% of Oklahomans went to the ballot box in November of 2016 and passed some of the most sweeping criminal justice reform measures anywhere in the country. And in the wake of that, you saw people like Representative Scott Biggs, aided and enabled by Speaker Charles McCall, the Oklahoma Sheriff's Association, the Fraternal Order of Police, prosecutors in particular, trying to roll back those efforts, literally steal the voice of the people of Oklahoma out from underneath them. And Sessions is in town today to reiterate that effort to undermine the will of Oklahomans, and he's doing so in a way that's dangerous. He wants us to go back in time, not forward, back in time to the harshest days of the war on drugs, which have decimated communities, that have filled our prisons to past the bursting point, and have made Oklahomans and Americans less safe than they were before the war on drugs. And so you see these folks out there. It's interesting. At the press conference yesterday, talking about the cuts to the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, you had Richard Smotherman, who's a district attorney out in Pottawatomie and Lincoln counties, and he was there to represent the District Attorney's Council, the Association of DAs. In his remarks, he talked about how devastating it would be to the people of Oklahoma to cut drug court and mental health courts. Well, you can't have your cake and eat it too, Mr. Smotherman, because your same organization has gone to the Capitol and lobbied against reforms that would have put money into those very services. But instead, you and your organization have lobbied for a status quo that fills our prisons and robs our coffers of needed money.
Democratic congressional candidate Kendra Horn outraises her opponent, Congressman Steve Russell, over the past 3 months. Horn raised more than $91,000, mostly through small donors, while Congressman Russell raised less than $91,000, mostly through political action committees. Ryan, what do you read into these numbers?
I think this is huge. We have heard around the country of the potential Democratic insurgency in congressional and U.S. Senate races coming up in this 2018 midterm, and largely in response to the failed administration of Donald Trump. And you know, the idea that that would trickle all the way down to Oklahoma, into some of the reddest precincts in the country, I think a lot of people would have shaken their head and said, there's no way, and that Kendra Horn or anybody else running in the 5th District was really only just going to be token opposition. That is not true. She is a credible opponent to Steve Russell, and I think that not only the fact that she outraised him, but that she was outraising him with small dollar donations in Oklahoma in that district is really telling, because those same folks, they've got skin in the game now, and they're going to be out on those doors. They're going to be in barbershops. They're going to be in cafes. They're going to be talking to their friends and neighbors in Sunday school. This is a campaign to watch. The 5th District in Oklahoma, I've said for a long time, the district that's going to flip first in this state is likely to be the 5th District, and Kendra may be the one to do it.
Neva?
Well, I mean, we have talked about, and I would agree with Ryan, that all of the trends and support the idea that this is the competitive district that over time is becoming more and more competitive for the Democrats to be able to look down the road and, have some optimism that they may be able to pick up the seat. It still may be a way off, though. I mean, there's no question that basically the fundraising was a dead heat. There were $202 a difference between the two. So, I mean, it was a statistical dead heat, but it's an important point that when you have someone that is a newcomer, has not run for public office, taking on an incumbent, and is able to compete at that level in a quarterly fundraising report, it gets noticed. And I think it begins to get on the radar not only in Oklahoma, but certainly nationally. Federal races, I mean, have a lot wider purview in terms of people paying attention. The fact that she's a woman, clearly, I mean, one of the things she said is that I think 70% of her early donors were women. So clearly that becomes a very important demographic that she certainly is trying to appeal to, both in the district and broader for fundraising purposes. So now, has Congressman Russell been embattled and had close races to this point? No. I mean, 24%, 20%. I mean, usually have been the margins of his victory. So, I mean, he's still well-positioned, but I think what we have to say, and I would agree with Ryan, is it's on the radar. It has the potential to be a more exciting race than many in the congressional races that we've seen in the past, and we'll see whether this develops. She certainly has a Democratic primary where, she's going to have to spend money against a perennial candidate in Tom Guild and a newcomer, Ed Porter, who's saying that he's running, so maybe others in the race. That also will be a factor. If she has to battle even against the folks that are less funded than she may be and use those funds to win the nomination against an incumbent who may or may not have a race in a primary, that will be a factor as well.
Is that something to consider also, the fact that she's got to fight at least two people we know in the primary?
I think that, Tom Guild is a good guy, and I think that, he's run this campaign I don't know how many times. Kendra Horn is the standout favorite in that primary. Barring the entry of the last minute entry of some big name into this campaign, I think that she wins that primary, probably wins it without a runoff. And at this point, given her fundraising performance, the likelihood of a big name candidate coming in and challenging her in that primary has been dramatically decreased. I don't think that that's going to happen at this point. In total transparency, for everyone listening, I'm one of those donors to the Kendra Horn campaign, so I just want to throw that out there so that folks know where I'm at. This doesn't have to be a situation like we talked about in the last segment,
which is always good. But I'm wondering about the fact that she's got this primary race, but no one's actually filed yet, because the filing doesn't happen until April. Is it possible that other people could say, well, she's raising more money, so I'll just drop out?
Well, I think that if you put that kind of money on the table, it's going to be difficult for another Democrat to get into that race. The only way that I see that happening is somebody coming in that could possibly self-finance to catch up. Mm-hmm. But to start at zero and have somebody who's already got this groundswell and has already excited a lot of Democrats around her campaign, that's a tall order.
But either way, an incumbent is always a difficult... It's always difficult in Oklahoma, just about anywhere.
Anywhere. I mean, yeah. I think the percentages nationwide bear that out.
The board in charge of legislator pay says lawmakers won't receive an increase in pay or benefits, but it's possible they could see a cut when the Legislative Compensation Board meets again in January. Legislative pay in Oklahoma hasn't changed since the 90s. At the time, $38,400 a year was one of the highest salaries for state legislators, legislatures in the U.S. Neva, do you think legislative pay should be cut?
Well, I think that's a question that's interesting in this season that we're in, because clearly I think what this board has done, they normally don't meet as often as they're now talking about, having just met, meeting again in January. It appears that this may be, again, somewhat of an orchestrated attempt to put pressure on the legislature and to kind of increase a public awareness and intensity on what's going on at the state capitol. I mean, you have someone, I mean, this composition of this board is 9 members, 5 of whom are appointed by the governor, 4 by the legislative leadership makes up the rest of that in terms of selections. So, I mean, it's a group that now is kind of showing some political moxie and kind of weighing in an interesting way. I mean, we've not seen legislative pay addressed for years.
Yeah.
I mean, the last time was when, in the late the 90s? I mean, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, do we get to the place where we try to use that as kind of the carrot and the stick scenario with these lawmakers? I'm not sure that's going to work very well, and I'm not sure it's really a serious conversation. We'll wait and see what they do when they come back in January.
Ryan?
You know, it's always popular to talk about cutting legislators' pay. I think it's a very populist issue. I think we need to be careful with it. I mean, if you look at what it takes to be a legislator, there are some legislators that are able to do this part-time, but I think a lot of legislators do this as a full-time job, and in some instances are prohibited from continuing their old job. If you're a school teacher or another state employee that's run for office, you have to leave that post, and you've given up your sole source of income to take this position. And, you know, the legislature shouldn't be a playground for the retired or the independently wealthy that can afford to live without any other source of income. And so, I mean, I think of your Representative Forrest Bennett, who works at one of the barbershops that I go to. I've been there. I see him sweeping the floor and you know, sitting at the front desk. But those jobs are tough to get. I mean, good for Capital City and Jake Phelps over there for giving him that job and allowing him the flexibility to go back and forth to the Capitol and meet with constituents. But that's tough. I had a law firm in Seminole that I worked at, and there was a part of the year that those guys didn't see me at all. And it was difficult for them. It was difficult for me to maintain that kind of practice. So, I think that, again, it's always popular, but we need to be careful, and we need to make this a position that people can take full time and devote their full energy to.
And again, the pay was at the time, I remember in the 90s when there was all this anger because they were one of the most wealthy paid. But now, because of inflation, because of everything else,
sure,
they're like 16th, I think, in the nation. So
I think that's the number I've seen.
It's not nearly as high a pay as it was before, especially I think the median income in Oklahoma is still something like $42,000. So it's still below what Oklahomans are making now.
Or approximately right at the 38.4. They get health insurance, they get investment, retirement, they get the per diem. But you're right, Ryan. I mean, it's a situation of what type of legislature do you want? I mean, we say this is a part-time legislature. You know, they come in February, they leave in May, but the reality is they have ongoing duties year-round. I mean, they're expected to do things in their district. If they're going to be, a really diligent lawmaker that's going to be involved in pursuing legislation that they're interested in, they're going to have interim studies, they're going to have meetings throughout the course of the rest of the year. So, I mean, this is something where you either have to have a very flexible a job that'll allow you that much time off, away to do that work, or you have to be retired, or as you say, you have someone who can self-fund, is not needing the income, and so the composition of the legislature is really dictated by this pay scale. And so to say that we're going to be mad at the legislature and we want to cut their pay to show them how mad we are at them, I agree with you. I think that's a dangerous course to go down. There are are more, ultimately the voters have the ultimate say at the ballot box.
Yeah, they get to hire and fire these folks.
They hire and fire, and that's the thing I think everyone sometimes doesn't take into account seriously enough. That's the real bottom line to all of this. If they're not happy with what these folks have done, they're going to have an opportunity in June and August and November of next year to make their voice really heard at the ballot box.
And even if you're still rehired, you can only keep the job for 12 years.
That's right.
Total.
Yeah. So it limits how long you can actually be in the office. Thank you very much. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.